Coming up next on 94.7 WPBC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something. Co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence, Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss the latest policies affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by Table 44 in Stanton and Moxie Hair Lounge on Preston Avenue in Charlottesville. And now, here's Ellen.
Welcome to Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, resistance radio, and I like to say persistence radio. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, welcome news about Welcoming Week, the annual celebration of our community's diversity, with the chair of Welcoming Greater Charlottesville, Russ Linden, and an AOS favorite, award-winning author, Kate Buford, returns. We're so glad Kate is back. Today, we get to explore her own writer's life, the famous subjects of her curiosity, with a focus on her business, Biography by Design, which creates custom biographies for corporations, institutions, individuals, and families. And with Kate's help, we hope to get a glimpse into how great biographies get made. A bit later, we'll get the 411 from Russ Linden on all the food, music, and highlights of Welcoming Week going on now in Charlottesville through September 22nd. But first, my friend, I'd like to welcome you to the airwaves. Are you there?
I am, Ellen. In honor of Kate, I'm going to take notes. I'm going to write this up, and then I ask her to make a novel of this particular episode. And I hope Kate is up for it. I'm counting on her.
Totally. Thank you.
And
so much. Yeah. No. Yes. I want to say what happened to the lazy days of summer? I want them back. I don't think we had any. I want a Democrat to promise a return to the lazy days of summer. I don't want this expression to go by the wayside.
It is. I mean,
what a summer.
It wasn't lazy. Although we were not really here doing too many live shows during the summer, so it's interesting to get back to the live shows, and I'm happy to do it with this great lineup, including you, Nance.
I agree. Maybe we'll have some lazy days of fall, but I think... I agree, Ellen. The summer just came and went, even though I know we weren't ushering in a lineup of people on the air. But I do want to say there is what's called the Out of Darkness Community Walks going on. Speaking of things going on, many of which are happening tomorrow. They're going to happen in the coming weeks. They are these Out of the Darkness Community Walks are held in hundreds of cities across the country. They're an opportunity to change our culture's approach to mental health and suicide prevention. And if you want to find out if one is happening near you, you just go to AFSP.org, which is the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and find a walk wherever you live. It's all in connection to September 10th, which is World Suicide Prevention Day.
Thank you, Nancy. I know. I think
you're welcome.
So many of us are affected by that. I think the numbers are very higher than we might think. So people are not alone. It's good to know that that's... Thank you for bringing that up. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, it's all... It's all happening. You know, there's just never... The needle on the record never seems to pick up. So, I'm good. I think we should... Well,
we should roll with Kate.
You should, because I certainly don't have the intro prepared.
All right.
Better than you.
I have a really good intro.
Than me.
So when Kate was here, I think it was in May, I got to, we both got to learn a lot about you. And then this time, there's so much more material. We got to know even more about you. So really happy you're back. And I'm going to give you a little introduction.
Okay, thank you.
Kate is the author of Native American Son, The Life and Sporting Legend of Jim Thorpe, an award-winning New York Times Editor's Choice biography. The book also won distinguished awards from the Society for American Baseball Research and the Professional Football Research Association. She's also the author of the critically acclaimed and best-selling biography, Burt Lancaster, An American Life, an Editor's Choice and Best Book of 2000 for the New York Times, Washington Post, and Los Angeles Times. She's been a commentator for NPR's Morning Edition. Her articles have been published in the New York Times, tons of other esteemed publications. She's appeared on HBO Real Sports, The Charlie Rose Show, and many more. She serves on the board of Biographers International Organization, Union Settlement Association in East Harlem, New York, and others. So again, welcome back to the program, Kate.
Thank you, Ellen. I'm delighted to be here.
Great. So you are, as I mentioned, a celebrated author, expert on biography. So thinking about your own life, growing up and through college and later, how were you and perhaps how are you now living a writer's life?
Oh, that's a great question. I remember saying to someone once, I think I lived my life as a writer, even though I didn't know I was a writer. And to answer your question, I just had this hunger for as many different kinds of experiences as possible. I had a bucket list that I had to get through, and I was assumed that I would get married. I wanted to have children, have a family. But once that happened, I would be more constrained. So I packed it in before that happened, and I had to live in Paris. I had to go to school abroad. I had to live in Manhattan. I just checked these things off. And looking back now, with reference to your question, it was just soaking up as much experience as I could. And I'm still that way. I like change. I like to learn and do something different. But there is a sort of method to what I always thought was kind of a madness. It actually has a continuum for the life of a writer.
Hey, Kate. Well, in all candor, now, was being a guest on this show on your bucket list? Don't answer. I don't want to know.
Of course.
Okay.
And it was on your list to come back.
Oh, yes, exactly. I'm so flattered and delighted to be asked back. It's great.
Well, how was, just to follow up on that, what was the method and what is that continuum?
Curiosity and learning as much as I can and being exposed to as many different kinds of people as possible. For example, this is a more down-home example, more recent. I moved to Lexington, Virginia from Manhattan about 10 years ago, and complicated story of why I got there, which is not relevant. But when I got there, I realized that there was, through the music, this, I felt like Margaret Mead in Samoa. You know, there was this indigenous culture, people who didn't go west. I'm from California, did not go west. They stayed there, and their music, what's now called bluegrass, which came over the ocean and down the valley to Rockbridge and then on into the rest of the South. All the kids, little tiny kids all the way up to 90-year-olds, knew all the songs. They knew the flatfoot dancing. I thought, where am I? How did this survive? I said, well, I'm living here until I figure this out. And ended up doing a series of pieces for Bluegrass Unlimited and thought I would write the next book on bluegrass. Did not do that for various reasons. But that's one more local and recent example. I just had to walk into that music and say, how did this survive and who are these people?
Well, your interest in change or being one who likes change or does that hinder or is that a good thing when you're trying to focus on your own writing or someone else's biography? Does that work for you or how does that work is my question.
Well, that's a really good question. And it kind of is relevant to the two big books that Ellen just mentioned, the one on Burt Lancaster, big Hollywood star and producer, and the next one on Jim Thorpe, the first major international celebrity athlete. Both of those are figures of so-called popular culture. And when you say to people, oh, you wrote a book about a movie star and an athlete, it's like, oh, they had to be minor books, you know, kind of genre-type books. But I deliberately chose figures of popular culture because I wanted to take two people, and I felt these two people were, that really would be revelatory about their times and their art, in the case of sports. But in terms of your question, most people, I think, biographers, would have gone on to write another movie book. Or if the sports book had come first, to just become known as a sports biographer. By nature, I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to keep doing movies, for example. I wanted to go on to a completely different field, which was sports. And in the world of publishing, that sometimes is not the best idea because people want to identify you as being with a particular genre. So it works both ways. It satisfied me, but and I have absolutely no regrets, but it was much more difficult to completely switch to a different area like sports.
So what about your interest in sports and Hollywood figures? And I did read something about a hospital you were born in. Did you think that affected your path?
I was born in St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica, California, which was known as the Hospital of the Stars at the time. And my father told me that Bing Crosby was either checking in or checking out when I was born. So this was sort of like, you know, a great feather in our cap. Well, California certainly influenced my decision to do a book about a movie star. Movies were, they weren't movies, they were life. I mean, movies were so important. And oddly enough, through most of my life, I thought they just kind of appeared on the screen. And then the first movie piece I wrote for Film Comment, Lincoln Center's very esteemed film criticism magazine, was about a movie called I Know Where I'm Going, which is an English film done in 1945 by the great Michael Powell. And this movie knocked me out. And I realized for the first time that movies are made, they're crafted. And that led to going into the movies, just like going into bluegrass music. I wanted to go into the movies. And I landed on Burt Lancaster, who no one had ever looked at seriously. And he was a remarkable star and also the leading independent producer in 50s Hollywood. And no one had put the pieces together. It was like hiding in plain sight. There it was. And that was just an amazing project. They all are. But and by nature, this craft of biography, you if you're going to do a really, really good one, it takes about 5 years, 6 years at least to interview all the people, do all the research. These are not light tasks by any means.
And did you discover, because this wasn't just, not that writing an article isn't time-consuming on its own, but doing a novel like that did, or biography, excuse me, did you discover you had the temperament for the length of that? Or how was that for you on your, you know, when you first started?
Oh, that's such a good question. I remember when I got signed the contract with Knopf. I mean, Knopf is like the best, right? And I had never written a book before. And I was so scared. I mean, I joked that I ate fear for breakfast every morning for 5 years. I had no idea if I could do this. And I remember at one point, my editor said, no, this is the second section was very complicated. And I had to do like five narrative threads at once. And I hadn't even done one. And he said, no, this is not professional. You have to redo it. And I did. And by the end, it felt like making gold out of straw, you know, like Rumpelstiltskin. And I never felt I knew how to do it. But evidently, I did. So there's an element of fear. There's an element of feeling like you're walking over Niagara Falls on a tightrope and you better not fall off.
That sounds so pleasant. You know, have 6 or 7 months of that and then an editor who looks at it all and tells you to rearrange. What? Anyway.
Oh, it's not pleasant.
What?
I said it's not pleasant. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah. How much pressure did you have then when you decided your second The book on Jim Thorpe was not going to be a book on someone in Hollywood, you know, as you mentioned. How much pressure did you have to stay in a pigeonhole, you know, in a box?
Well, luckily, the publisher, Knopf, is, as the editor said, they look for the definitive book on a given subject. It has to define, as he put it, define the terrain. So in the case of Lancaster, it was defining post-war Hollywood through this remarkable star and producer who changed the way movies were made. For Jim Thorpe, they gave me the freedom to switch to a completely different topic. They weren't going to push me to do the same thing. They respected the fact that I would be able to do it, even though I might have not thought I was able to do it. And sports, I thought, okay, what's the next sector I can go into? And I thought, what is the common passion of our time? It's sports. The language of sports, you know, home run, hit it out of the park, spike the ball, da-da-da-da-da-da. Where does this passion for sports that now, of course, crosses all genders and ages come from? And Burt Lancaster had played Jim Thorpe in a 1951 Warner Brothers biopic. And as I was doing the research out at USC, where the film scripts and production files were, I was so struck by this remarkable story of this Native American kid from Oklahoma and who went on to be this enormously skilled athlete in so many different sports. And I thought, where does this passion for sports begin? And I argue it began with Jim Thorpe. So again, I'm defining the terrain of sports. Where does it start? Where does football start? Where does baseball start? Where does basketball start? But then you also weave in the whole Native American story. Here's this kid from Oklahoma who goes to the most famous Indian boarding school, Carlisle, in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. So I had to immerse myself in Native American history, about which I was ignorant. And so that's an element that was very different from Lancaster. I had to read this incredibly painful story and history and educate myself. So it had a whole different set of challenges.
So that took you 8 years, is that correct?
No, more like six.
Okay, six years, a long time. What do you think is important about his story? And I just read a little bit about there's like an epitaph, I believe. Maybe you can update us what happened with a court case involving him.
The body, right. Yeah, can't make it up. Yeah, I'm sorry, what was your question again?
What's important about that story?
Because, oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. What's important is, well, that he's a sort of a paradigm of the athlete. You know, all athletes, because it's a bodily exercise, sports, they will be really good and peak at a certain point, but then what happens with the rest of their lives? And Jim Thorpe became a sort of emblematic case history on what happens to the great athlete when he's no longer the great athlete. And in Thorpe's case, and apropos of this show being a progressive radio show, he always was on the right side of progressive politics. He had to be. He was a Native American. They'd been prejudiced against and treated so badly by the American government. So when he gets to Hollywood, he goes to Hollywood in the 30s when he can no longer play sports, and creates a whole casting company to force the studios to hire Native Americans, Indians, to play Indian roles. Hollywood studios were none too fussy. Italians, Greeks, anybody sort of other, you know, of color or vaguely dark could play anything. And Jim Thorpe felt really strongly that it should be authentic, they should play themselves, and that I found fascinating. So that was how he charted his life after he left sports. And he did have a problem with alcohol, but then so did so many other people back then. And it got exaggerated often. So I was combating this idea that he was just a wreck and a failure after the 1912 Olympics when he won the pentathlon and decathlon. I discovered it was anything but that. So it was reviving a life and giving a value and a sympathy to a life that had been sort of relegated to a peaking high point, and then the rest was sort of disaster and sadness. And that was very meaningful for me.
What did fellow Native Americans think of his film career, you know, his second career? How was, or I probably shouldn't generalize, or was there a general feeling from a fellow Native Americans about the work he was doing in Hollywood after his amazing Olympic career?
Yeah, that's a good question. After the 1920s, which is the so-called golden age of sports, so many athletes, both Native American and not, flooded to Los Angeles because they could get work in the movies. You know, they were physically adept. They could be stuntmen or women. And so a whole diaspora of Native Americans and former athletes came to Hollywood to work. And so there was great admiration for his efforts to cast them in movies. But also another really fascinating aspect of Thorpe's move to Hollywood was that he got back in touch after being in a Native American boarding school and playing for big major league teams in football and baseball. He got back to his Indian roots. So he began to be the spokesperson for Indian rights. He was the most famous Native American at that time. And so he became, almost in spite of himself, the one that Native Americans turned to push their agenda, to make their needs known to politicians and in Washington.
You are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. I'm Ellen Daniels. I'm here with my co-host Nancy Lawrence and Kate Buford, New York Times Editor's Choice Biographer. Her websites are biographybydesign.com and katebuford.com, chock full of information. We'll be right back with Kate after this. Don't go away. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. My name's Ellen Daniels. I'm here, again, as I mentioned, with Nancy Lawrence, my co-host, and Kate Buford. In a little bit, we're going to talk with Russ Linden about Welcoming Week going on this week in Charlottesville. Just before we move on to the next question, I wanted to wrap up with Jim Thorpe. What happened with his family after he died?
Yes, it's a famous or infamous story of the body, Thorpe's body. And he had a difficult widow at the time, and she wanted him to have an appropriate mausoleum and sort of like Will Rogers's huge burial place in Oklahoma. And so the body, to make a long story short, ended up being in, oh, I've forgotten how many now, but let's say five or six different locations, different funeral homes, different keeping places. Finally, it ended up that the town of Carlisle in, the town of Malchunk in Pennsylvania, she struck a deal with this little town that if they took the body and made an appropriate memorial to him and gravesite for him, that they could change the name of their town to Jim Thorpe. And they were battling with this. There were two little tiny towns crossing the river, one Irish, one German, and they couldn't agree on anything, and they had duplicate municipal services. And one of the leading people of one of the towns felt they have to combine somehow. He already felt that. So when Mrs. Thorpe comes with this bizarre idea, he said, well, maybe that'll work. So that's what they did. Jim Thorpe had never been in Malchunk. He had nothing to do with it, although he, of course, was very connected with Pennsylvania through the Carlisle Indian School. So after all these different resting places, he was then buried in what is now called Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania. It was a really bizarre story.
I'm shoehorning this into my next question in all fairness, but a question that I had for you, though, is how did you become involved with, I know it was on PBS because I watched it, Mystery Detectives, and I bring that up now only because you mentioned, like, this sounds like something that you would be asked about on Mystery Detectives versus writing a biography on Jim Thorpe, so I ask you, Kate, how did you become involved with Mystery Detectives?
Well, they asked me to come on the show, and it was filmed in Carlisle, and it was about an aspect of Jim Thorpe's story. So it was really an introduction to the school, which is now the Army War College. But almost all the original buildings are still there in the central quadrangle, the school as Jim Thorpe would have seen it. So that was part of the mystery, was to revive and explain Jim's history at that Indian school. And I went because they asked, and it was a really interesting experience.
So I'd love to know what you want to write now, but I really want to get to biography by design, and I can see why you are the person to write a family or organization's biography. So tell us what it is, how it began.
Well, I think it began with this organization, which is now going into its 11th year, called Biographers International Organization, that you mentioned, that I'm on the board of, and one of the founding members. And it's a terrific organization. And I have this theory that good biographers are really nice people, because you have to respect another person. You have his or her life in your hands, or if it's a multiple biography, several lives in your hands. You have to be fair. It's really a philosophical challenge, a moral challenge, actually. It's a moral exercise. Why did this person do what they did? How do I treat that fairly in the context of their lives? So another biographer, another member of this bio organization, Abigail Santa Maria, who lives in Manhattan, she and I had roughly the same idea at the same time. Why don't we use our biography skills for the benefit of non-famous people, ordinary families, individuals, nonprofits, corporations, firms like law firms, who want their story told? I had done two of these private histories before that I just loved doing. I loved walking into the family in one case, and the other was a country club of all things, but one of the very earliest country clubs, and in New York. And again, that history was actually a social and cultural history of the area around New York, because the club mirrored that. How do we set up this company to help individuals craft their story. And typically someone will come to us, let's say it's a family, and they want to do a legacy project, as the word goes, to have the history of the family for their descendants and for the family that's alive now. And typically they'll come in with a whole shoeboxes of materials and old photographs and maybe some letters, and they say, what do we do with this? Where do we start? And that's actually one of the most fun parts, because then what you're looking for is the narrative line. You're looking for, where's the thread in this family's history? What was important to them? Because, again, going back to what I said earlier, nothing happens just out of the blue. People do things for a reason. So how did this family develop? What did they do? What is meaningful for them now? And what sort of legacy do they want to leave? So we started it 3 years ago, Biography by Design, with the New York office and me here. And then now we have someone in Los Angeles, actually. And it's been a blast. I mean, we have done really amazing projects, in my opinion. Some of them here in Virginia, of course, New York. The most ambitious project is just wrapping up now, which is I've been working on a multinational in Hong Kong, and went to Hong Kong in November and met this remarkable Chinese family whose grandparents created this company that is now a multinational. And it was this immersion in Chinese culture that, again, I mean, going back to your very first question, I knew nothing about Hong Kong. I knew very little about Chinese culture, but my daughter-in-law is of Chinese descent. So that has been another huge challenge and has turned out very well. But so we have a range of different projects, and it's coming along quite nicely, very meaningful.
How do you gain, I know they possibly, most likely they come to you first, but how do you gain their trust in, if they're reluctant, you know, to share documents, details, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a question also that applied to the two commercial biographies. How do you gain trust? In the case, this is interesting, in the case of Burt Lancaster, his widow ended up, who remains a friend, ended up being essential because he was so private. And as long as she said I was okay, I had to gain her trust first, then everything opened up. But to the current company, Biography by Design, well, we come in with credentials, so they can look at what we've done, and they can know that it's of a very high level and a very high quality. It has been recognized both commercially and now on a private level. The biggest question on getting trust is, what is the truth? And not to be afraid of the truth. Every family has skeletons. Every family has something they would rather not reveal. One client I'm working for now is an actress in New York, and her father had some run-ins with the law, and I said, you know, that must have had a huge impact on the family. You should talk about that. She goes, oh, I don't know about that. And she said, I have to talk to the rest of the family. And I said, well, it's the truth. I mean, it's your call. It's your call. In this case, it's your call. In the commercial biographies, you might do it anyway because it explains why people did what they did, which is the core question. But you have to reassure them that the truth is best, but it has to be carefully contextualized. And again, going back to that original question, why did the person do what they did? And if you can contextualize that difficult scandal or whatever within that, it usually is okay.
Can you tell us more about that Hong Kong family?
Yeah, they're amazing. The founding couple were from, well, they ended up in Shanghai in the 1920s. And which, as some of the listeners will know, is an amazing place, one of the most sophisticated cities on the planet at the time. And they were basically uneducated. And the father was a son of a peasant. And they worked their way up and became entrepreneurs. And the Chinese are amazing entrepreneurs. So they had several, they eventually married, businesses in Shanghai. And Shanghai, again, those who know the history of that area, as you go into the 1930s and then the late 30s and Japanese occupation and then World War II and then the communist takeover in 49, they lived through all that and ended up being refugees in Hong Kong, as were thousands of others who fled the mainland with the communist takeover. So you trace, that was the first part of this history, which was so interesting, was how they kept adapting, making money, and ending up in Hong Kong. So what's Hong Kong like in the late 40s and 50s? you have to delve into that. Again, fascinating piece of history, again, about which I knew nothing. So then at the end of the 50s, the father of this couple formed this company to make a form of motor. And that's what ended up being, two or three decades later, a multinational. They're coming up to their 60th anniversary, which is the occasion for the writing of this history. So the family, now I'm the two founders, well, the woman is still alive. She's 100, over 100. I'm now dealing with their children, their five children and grandchildren, and a really lovely family and super smart and super competent. And of course, all that's been going on in Hong Kong, which started started to happen after I left. One of the benefits of being a biographer or any kind of writer is, oh, now I know where they're marching, where the streets are. I know a little bit about Hong Kong, so, and the issues. So all of that is much more vivid and real to me, as thanks to this project.
Just a quick follow-up. Do you ever think about making any of these stories, with permission, of course, into something bigger, into something commercial?
There's talk of doing that with this Hong Kong history, and that's going to depend on the family. It would not be a mega bestseller. It's a very particular kind of book, but actually the CEO goes frequently to Harvard for different executive sessions, and he's been under pressure from Harvard Business School to let them do a case study of this company, and they don't want to do it because it would take too much time and work from the company itself. But in effect, this history is a case study of a Chinese entrepreneurial family. And then this company. We had to go deeply into the corporate culture and how it evolved and how it became a multinational. So in effect, the book becomes a case study. So that would have value for a lot of people. But we're not there yet. It's almost finished. It's going to be printed in December. So stay tuned. I'll let you know.
Stay tuned. She's already writing. She's writing her way out of this interview already. And Kate, I was wondering, how do people find your company? Do they read your? Do many of them read your biographies first, or are they aware of your website?
This business, I feel, relies on word of mouth. So the first few clients that came in were referrals from people, or actual people themselves, clients themselves, people I knew. And when they learned that I was doing this, they said, oh, good, okay, I want you to write a history of my family. Or I want you to write a history of our nonprofit. And then it's a slow process, but then they refer their friends to us. And we've found, so far, we're only 3 years in, but we've found that the quality of the client is so much better when it's a referral, that the person knows us, and then we've done work for them, they recommend us to their friends and to their circle, or to their corporate circle or commercial circle, depending on the nature of the client. So it's basically word of mouth.
And I was curious about this since the last time you were on our show, when I read that you had said your career as a law librarian has been actually a plus to your now, you know, your later career, your current career as a writer, a biographer, et cetera. I'm just wondering, what is that connection? What was the value there?
That's going back to my first career.
Yeah.
Yes, I got a master's in library science at Columbia, and then with a specialty in law libraries, and worked on Wall Street for several years. And the nature of that work was that a partner would come in and say, I need to find out everything about X company, because it was a possible client, for example. So you had to do deep research and be able to find out the answer to anything yesterday. And I had a staff working for me. But the work was heavily research based. So as a librarian, you know you can find the answer to anything. You just have to work hard enough to find it. And that was a great preparation for nonfiction writing.
And you wrote that you decided you wanted to be the person asking for the books rather than the one handing them over.
Absolutely, yes. I think I got tired of that. I didn't want to be giving other people the fun stuff to do. I wanted to do it myself.
Yeah. So I'm glad that you did decide that. And what about is there another family that you wanted to highlight?
Well, there's a wonderful Virginia family that I did a little short history of their project to develop their parents' land in Goochland. And they wanted to do it environmentally, in a sensitive environmental way. They wanted to set it up that it went with the curve of the land and it respected the different wildlife and the different hedgerows and the rivers and the streams. Very distinguished family with it made a huge impact on the story of Virginia. And I just loved that project. It was really, it wasn't a big book, but it was a tight, focused little book. And they'd done the right thing, speaking of apropos of something. I should mention quickly, I mean, this is going off on a tangent a little bit, but Burt Lancaster was a true blue progressive. I mean, he grew up in East Harlem, which was a heavily reform-based area of New York full of immigrants. And he drank the Kool-Aid, and he kept it his whole life quietly. But he was a huge, faithful star in Hollywood to progressive causes. So I have to mention that since that's the focus of this show.
I'm glad you did.
Yeah, he survived. He was one of the few. How did he survive the House Un-American Activities Committee? He was on that blacklist. How did he survive that?
Yeah, that's a good question. That was one of the most interesting and exciting parts of research on that. In general, House Un-American Activities Committee did not go after the big stars because they were afraid of the backlash from the public. I mean, they weren't going to touch Gregory Peck or Jimmy Stewart or Burt Lancaster. They went after the low-hanging fruit, the poor screenwriters, often Jewish as well. They had a particular animus against them. And so Lancaster, because he was such a huge star, I mean, he was an overnight success in the late 40s. So by the 50s, when this House Un-American Activities Committee is getting going, he has so much power and so much clout that they leave him alone. But he quietly hires blacklisted writers to work on his films, because he's a producer. He can have that wherewithal. So he navigated it very interesting way, and that was one of the most fun parts to do in the book.
Well, thank you, Kate. It was a delight to have you back.
And thank you.
We'll have you back again.
Oh, yeah. Next, stay tuned.
Whatever. Like in a few more months.
Thank you, Ellen.
Yeah, your websites are biographybydesign.com and katebuford.com. I really enjoyed learning more about you on those websites. So, again, thank you so much for being here. We're going to go to a break, and we'll be right back. We're going to learn about Welcoming Week in Charlottesville with Russ Linden. Welcome back, everyone. This is 94.7 WPVC, as I mentioned, and we're here now with Russ Linden. Welcome to the show, Russ.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So you are chair of Welcoming Greater Charlottesville. Tell us what that is and how that came to be.
Great. It's a good place to start. About 2.5 years ago, soon after the Trump inauguration, there was a lot of talk about resistance. You folks talk about resistance radio, a lot of anxiety, anger, energy, what should be done. And a group of us got together under the leadership of the former mayor, Mike Signer, former Charlottesville mayor, and we formed a group called Welcoming Greater Charlottesville, and then we tried to figure out what we were going to do. and we know that there were some groups already in place that were doing advocacy, they were doing legal assistance, and so we put our emphasis, Ellen, on education. How can we help people get past stereotypes when they think about immigrants and refugees? We're in another part of our history, which sadly has happened many other times when people were afraid of folks from elsewhere, as you know. How can we get past the stereotypes and the fear and help people learn why so many people come here from other countries? My dad came here from another country to flee oppression in Russia, my mom's parents as well. What's the struggle like to get here? It's not easy at all. People from Central America could and are writing books about that. And once they get here, how do they make contributions? One of the fears is that folks from elsewhere take our jobs. Well, it turns out the facts, there are some things called facts these days. The facts show that they contribute to the economy. They pay taxes. They create businesses. You go to Silicon Valley, you can't count the number of high-tech firms that are started or maintained by people from other countries. So our goal, our purpose is to help people locally, Charlottesville, Albemarle, learn and appreciate and value people from elsewhere, their cultures, their contributions, and as I said, to break through some of the stereotypes and help the human face come through.
I was wondering, Russ, what, because it seems to have gone up more than a few notches since his inauguration, are you finding people, immigrants and local people, more engaged in your work? Or I'll leave it there. Are they more engaged or are they, staying away for fear of I don't know what.
Well, the last thing you said, there's an enormous amount of fear, especially among immigrants, whether they're here legally or not. The engagement has, surprising to me, I thought it might die down after the initial, you know, rush. The engagement has continued and in many ways increased. We see so many things coming out of Washington, and not only out of Washington, there are things going on around the world that are the same challenges and concerns. So every day, every week, we read something and people right away say, what can I do? We held, not my group, but a series of groups like mine, held a forum about a week ago at Congregation Beth Israel, where three people who have recently gone to the southern border, crossed over, and met with migrants, people trying to cross the border, not able to. One was an attorney, and two were people who deal with trauma. And they counseled and helped these people and came back with the harrowing stories of what we're learning. And we had 130 people at the event. We had seven or eight local groups like mine, Welcoming Greater Charlottesville, there. And dozens of people who came back to these tables at the end of the event saying, what can I do? So there's a continuing, for the saddest, most awful reasons, a continuing thrust of energy, and we're focusing on what we can do locally.
So what would you advise people? Thanksgiving is coming up.
Yes.
At the Thanksgiving table, with divergent opinions, and people say, because some people are hearing a totally different story,
yes,
right? And they're hearing, they're taking our jobs, what is, you know, all that stuff that you know. So what? How would you counteract that argument?
Well, there's some people who you don't counteract it with because facts are not going to be helpful. And so there are members of my extended family where we just skip that topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But one of the things that, in fact, the person who you just had on the show for 40 minutes, I'm delighted to meet Kate. One of the things that Kate knows so well and one of the things we're learning is the power of stories. I know someone who says once you know someone's story, it's harder to hate them. And so boiling it down to the individual and what's their life like, I'll give you an analogy. I'm one of many, many people who were and still are amazed at how it seemed almost within a year or two, people started to say in this country, wow, I know some people who are gay. I never knew they were gay. All I knew is they were a good person, as dull as me, as exciting as me. And now I'm hearing about gay marriage and it doesn't seem so scary. So learning about issues through the voice of people's stories is one of the ways to deal with this.
And what are some of the ways, aside from Welcoming Week, more specifically your organization, Welcoming Greater Charlottesville, how do you support, what are the supports you provide for immigrants? What are some of those examples?
Again, our job is primarily, our mission is primarily education. So in our first year, we had one member of our group who is a filmmaker. And he went out and with the help of the local IRC, the group that brings in and settles refugees, and a couple of groups that work with immigrants, he found eight or nine people who came from other countries. He did, I think it was about a 40-minute documentary, again, each of them telling their stories, what it was like, where they came from, why did they leave. So in some cases, they left everybody and everything they knew. How do you start over again? And so these stories, and as we know, people are visual learners in a compelling documentary, were very helpful, were very moving. One of my favorite examples is that same year, a couple of years ago, some of us on our welcoming task force learned about a group of teenagers who have been detained for a few years in a Staten jail. They haven't done anything wrong. They're waiting for their trial to see if they can gain asylum. It's a long waiting period. And that's the place that they happen to be held. So these kids, not wanting to just sit there and waste away, started to write poems. Somebody learned about the poems. The poems became a book called Dreaming America. Somebody told kids at this local CHS, Charlottesville High School, about this book. These kids at CHS read the book. They put on their own performance using some of the poems, dramatizing the plight of kids their age from other countries. So that was very powerful. And then the most recent program we're doing, back to your question, what are we doing locally besides Welcoming Charlotte's, a Welcoming Week, is about 6 months ago we started a new program. We're one of 20-some communities doing this. It's a photo ID program giving verifiable photo IDs to people who have a hard time getting a government ID. So it's not the same as a driver's license. It doesn't give you the right to drive legally, but it opens a lot of doors because, you know, most of us who have always had IDs don't think about how often we have to show an ID. So you want to enroll your kids in school? Where's your ID? You want to go to a hotel, where's your ID? You need some social services, where's your ID? You need to get water and gas because you just moved. So this is an ID program that's caught on. We've given out over 450 IDs since last March. And it's the most tangible way that we're helping immigrants.
And voting, did you mention? I mean, can they use that to vote?
Unfortunately, no. Okay. You have to be a citizen, and some of these folks, most of these folks who get our IDs are not citizens yet.
Okay. Well, that's really, really great. How is Charlottesville doing in terms of welcoming people? And do you think we've come together at all since the election and since the riots here?
Wow. Do we have an hour?
No.
Before August of 17, even with the election, I and many people, but certainly not all, would have said, we see ourselves, Charlottesville and Albemarle, as a very welcoming place, very inclusive place. It seems there are endless numbers of programs to teach people English as a second language, to help kids who are struggling in school from wherever they come, etc. But something's happened. Anyone who's been here since August knows that there's been a fracture in our community that hasn't healed. Still an enormous amount of anger. And one of the reasons for the anger, one of many reasons, is there's all these questions that haven't been answered. Why did the police not protect us? I work with police. By nature, they move into a fracas. They move in when people are hitting each other. Here they stood back. We know that only happened because they were given orders. We've never learned where the orders came from. Why was the street where Heather Heyer was killed? It was closed in that morning. Why did it get open? We haven't heard answers. So as we all know, when there's a lack of information and there's a crisis, people make things up. Not necessarily trying to lie. It's just people are uncomfortable with not knowing. So we make it up, and it's just been a very painful time. That said, if you talk to any of the hundreds of refugees who come here through the services of the International Rescue Committee, IRC, you'll find that, and I've talked with these folks, they feel that this is an incredibly welcoming community. The schools open them with open arms. Schools, by the way, by law, educate everyone. It doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter if you're here with documents or not. And the schools have been a great melting pot.
What about the events you are planning for Welcoming Week that are coming up?
I'm so glad you asked.
Yeah.
Welcoming Week has gone on around the country.
We'd be horrible if we didn't. Anyway, please.
Welcoming Week's going on around the country. It's sponsored by a network called Welcoming America, and Charlottesville's part of that network. Real briefly, it started yesterday. It goes through tomorrow, a week from tomorrow. Some of the activities, today is the eighth annual Charlottesville Pride Festival. It's downtown at the Pavilion. There's a program today at Northside Library, All Things Irish. Welcoming Week is trying to shine a spotlight on different cultures as well as people. So this is music and dances from Ireland, Northside, today at 3. There's a simulation, something that in my professional world I love to do, on Monday, the 16th. Walk 6,000 miles in my shoes. If you go to Northside Library from 6 to 8, you'll go through a very simple structured simulation where you'll learn a lot of the stumbling blocks and challenges and ultimately opportunities for people who try to come here as refugees. Two of my favorite activities, this year we have two nationally known writers, Lee Bisell, who's a humanitarian who has worked in South Sudan and Darfur in terrible places, awful places to try to survive. And he's written a book about 11 refugees he's come to know. The book is called Refugees in America. And on the 18th, 12 noon at UVA, and then again on the 19th at the local congregation downtown, Lee Bisell is going to talk about what he learned about these remarkable refugees. Probably the best-known person coming to our town this year is Sonia Nazario. She's the author of Enrique's Journey. This is about a young boy put on a train by parents who could not leave his Central American state filled with gangs and violence, and the horrible situations he had to go through to ultimately come to our country. She's speaking at the Haven on the evening of September 18th, a remarkable person. She herself has gone to some of these violence-ravaged states and countries at risk to herself, this novelist, Sonia Nazario. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner and a remarkable person. There's a movie, lots of movies. One's called McFarlane USA. It's about a track coach who goes to a different school to teach the kids track, and he's got a school primarily with Latino kids about whom he knows nothing. culture he's never encountered before. And it's not about how he teaches the kids. It's about how they teach him something about the tremendous family love and tightness that Latinos tend to have. Something at the very end, it's a little bit after Welcoming Week, but on October 5th, a multicultural health festival. This is sponsored by several local groups. It's for people from all backgrounds. You're going to learn how your blood pressure is. You're going to get health screenings, get a flu shot. There's activities. There's information about nutrition. And finally, another one of my favorites. A week from today, Seville Sabroso, from 12 to 9 o'clock at the Ix Park, is a celebration of Latino culture. Food, dancing, speakers. Did I mention food? One of my favorites. Seville Sabroso is on the 22nd. Seville Sabroso at Ix Park.
And then today, Seville Pride, I also saw on the website.
Seville Pride is all day at the pavilion starting at 11 right now.
Until 7, I believe. And all of these events are on wgseville.org.
wgseville.org. And if you just click on that and then look at schedule of events, you'll see all of these and more.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, Russ, I was just wondering how beyond this week's events, though they are amazing. And anyway, my question is simply, how can people get involved beyond, you know, this week, participating in the diverse programming?
Great question. If you go to our website and go down to the bottom, you'll see how to reach me. My email is russlinden1946@gmail.com. And that's on the bottom of the website. We'd love to have more volunteers.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Russ.
My pleasure.
Run out of time, but it was a delight to have you as well. Very articulate.
Too.
It was great to hear about what you're doing.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. And Nancy, thank you for being here every week, my dear friend. And our music is by Springtide. And remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone needs to do something.
Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Join hosts Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by Table 44 in Stanton and Moxie Hair Lounge on Preston Avenue in Charlottesville. Show archives can be found at 947WPVC.org or you can subscribe on iTunes.